Yeah, hey, Jeff, I saw I read the article that you, I guess, put together with Jeremy Schwartz on potential market outcomes with the election. And that's really no big surprise. I mean, I know you guys wrote that because you're probably getting a lot of calls from a lot of people, right?
You think?
And a lot of clients want to know, like, hey, what's going to happen? So I appreciate the article. I just had some questions that kind of tie into it for some clarification
Sure.
on some of the things were said. So let me just dive right into it because I think, I first of all, I like the idea of the different scenarios. You have the first one being the blue wave, and then you go on to where the GOP keeps the Senate, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, a red wave, which I don't think anybody's actually anticipating that. But I want to focus on the first one, which is the blue wave, because I know a lot of people have been concerned Democrats get control. They think that Trump is really, what's best for the market. But in reading your assessment of a blue wave may not necessarily be that bad, with this idea of, I guess, government spending may kind of accelerate some things that normally would take a little bit longer. So I want to know if you could kind of elaborate a little bit onto the blue wave outcome, that could happen, and whether or not that really, is really not necessarily bad for the market.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, there's moving parts too, right? So at any given day that you discuss these matters, things change. So for example, I mean, we just recently had antitrust action coming from essentially the Department of Justice Trump administration against Google, right? And that's something that's just really crept into the fray heavily in the last 6 to 12 months, but is really hitting the wires right now in real time, October 2020, right? And so this is a big part of the marketplace because as Google goes, you have a does the Trump administration get crushed on November 3rd, or is it a close one where this blue wave doesn't materialize because it's still a Republican Senate, but it's a Biden victory? And so now we have question marks on Silicon Valley. All of these various things come into play. If we want to discuss specifically the blue wave scenario, there's a few things going on. So let me lay it out for you like this. Whenever there's something that's priced into the market, if that outcome occurs, then the market shouldn't have a violent reaction in any given direction because you wake up and that is the common expectation. So right now, the street is on a blue wave thesis. Now, whether or not that comes into play, your guess, my guess, right? But specifically in the blue wave outcome, you have a few things. One is you wake up when that's decided in December or January, because it's not going to be decided on November 4th. And I think that's understood.
Right.
And it's kind of a yawn because it's not going to surprise anyone. Kind of like the exact opposite, which is the one that you laid out. You said, I don't think anybody's anticipating the red wave, right? So there is, within the realm of possibility, within reasonable possibility, a Trump victory plus Republican Senate, but it's pretty outlandish, at least in market consensus, that you'd have Trump victory plus Republican Senate plus Republican House, because Republicans taking the House is the real long shot. That's about a 9-to-1 probability in current futures markets. So the one that's the base case is the blue wave. Now, there's a few things, and I've taken your question and I've expounded upon it. So allow me that. There's a few things going on. There's in a Biden administration, you have a combination of expansionary fiscal spending, but contractionary fiscal taxation, right? So you have the reversal of the Trump tax cuts. You have a potential doubling of capital gains rates for those that are, and that's now, it's now a situation where the capital gains taxation becomes one and the same with your annual income, believe it or not, where they would revert your capital gains if you're earning more than $1 million annually to the 39.6 that we associate with the Obama era tax code on high earners. And then one of the other critical things that I think in terms of market dynamics is in this blue wave scenario, you have a partial reversal of the corporate tax cuts that were implemented back in 2017. So we used to have a 35% corporate tax rate. That was reduced to 21% by the Trump tax cuts. Trump if Trump was to be victorious, he would keep it at 21, and maybe he was even talking about taking it to 20 or 19. These are negligible amounts, but the Biden plank would have it back up to 28. So in that situation, there's now some, there's some moving and shaking here going on, because the financials, the banks themselves would be hindered by, because they tend to pay the closest thing to the statutory tax rate. And so banks would be seemingly harmed by a Biden administration. The other part of that equation is essentially as it pertains to value versus growth. The two main concepts within the market is, and maybe we want to go down this path, maybe we don't, is really what it means for the tech sector. Because you could say, because you can play this two-handed economist. You know how we joke about the two-handed economist. On the one hand, the Biden administration and the tax code would ratchet up to a minimum tax rate on Silicon Valley, which is notorious for paying zero in taxes. And we've seen that from Silicon Valley. We've seen it in the past from Amazon, even Starbucks at sometimes. So that's something that's a hindrance. However, a Biden administration may be more friendly to Silicon Valley from the regulatory side, because really the pressure is coming from the Republicans on Twitter and Facebook and Google. And so you could argue that perhaps the Biden administration would be something that would be a net positive from this perspective for the S&P 500, because at the top of the S&P, it's Amazon, it's Google, it's Facebook.
So for the investors that have been waiting for value stocks to actually come back into favor,
yeah,
there's probably, what you're saying is, if with a Biden presidency or a blue wave, that's probably going to be delayed a little bit further than what people are expecting.
Okay, so there's a few takes on this one. I tend to anticipate that value stocks would be more receptive to a Trump administration, and that growth would be more receptive to a Biden administration. I'll give you some of the countervailing arguments that I've heard. When you think about what populates value indexes relative to growth indexes, tends to be energy, for example, is a sector that's more in value, because growth is communication services and tech and things that you associate young people working on a laptop in a coffee shop with a barista, right? that's growth stocks. The argument is that in a Biden administration in which you would be ratcheting up, say, Environmental Protection Agency measures, that seemingly what that could end up doing is sending the crude oil price up higher, because you're not open to unlimited pumping from a state of like Texas or North Carolina, something like that, or North Dakota, excuse me. And then when you get the crude oil price up to $50 or $60 as a result of that, that would actually help the ExxonMobils and ConocoPhillips of the world. That's one argument. However, I think that that's getting a little too cute with the analysis. It seems plain as day that there's a pair trade in this marketplace. Alternative energy is Green New Deal type stuff, and classic fossil fuels is GOP type stuff. And that's really the simple A equals B connecting the dots in market analysis. So from that perspective, that specific sector, it tends to be Trump value, Biden growth. The other one is financials, and we didn't really get into it so much with the corporate income tax, but the other issue with respect to financials that I think is front and center in the marketplace. So go back 6-12 months. Before it was Biden, it was really Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren seemingly leading the pack till the Democratic Party came around to Biden. So there's a notion floating around inside the halls of the left to implement a financial transactions tax. And so this could be something that would be harmful to the Citis and Goldmans of the world. Reason being, because what it does is, this has been tried in some countries in the past. You're trying to raise $1 trillion over 10 years or a couple trillion over 10 years, but you siphon off of a half of a penny or a tenth of a penny from each share of IBM that somebody buys, right? So somebody buys 100 shares of IBM, maybe you're taking a half of a penny from each of those, and so it goes. You do it for equities, you do it for fixed income, you do it for derivatives, you do it everywhere. This could be something that hinders market liquidity, right? Because our faith in going out and buying and selling ETFs, buying and selling IBM, Procter & Gamble, whatever the case may be, is that you can get an easy fill on a bid-ask spread. You don't have to pay too much in commissions, and that's what makes the United States the place that you want to transact. To the extent that, and now this is the critical part here, Michael, to the extent that Biden makes a decision on his Treasury Secretary, that can affect the fate of growth and value because it affects the financials, the banks, that so populate value indexes. So you have two potential outcomes. I think the most likely outcome is that he selects Brainard from the Fed, and then she becomes the Treasury Secretary. That is the left of center viewpoint, which is considered market friendly. The farther left viewpoint, of course, I'm on a camera, so as I go like this, I'm moving to my left. I might be to your right on the optics of it.
Right.
The farther left would be taking Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, making her Treasury Secretary, which is considered the underdog. That's considered the second likeliest. Brainard is pretty much the likeliest. If it does end up being Elizabeth Warren in the as a Treasury Secretary, that could be something that takes fright among the investment banks and causes that sector to underperform.
Right. Good. So let me ask you this. And another big question that is on a lot of investors' mind is inflationary factors. Is the blue wave in government spending something that should drive or potentially push inflationary factors?
Okay. So with inflation, I could argue convincingly in either direction because I tend to think inflation is coming no matter what. So let's take this blue wave scenario because it sounds Michael, like that's your base case.
Right.
You could argue that you don't have as much inflation from the Democrats as the Republicans because to the extent that you have, for example, infrastructure and Green New Deal spending to the tune of trillions of dollars, which is inflationary, you also have the aforementioned tax hikes that I mentioned, which would seemingly rein in the impulses of the upper middle class and the middle and the upper class to purchase another Rolex, to purchase a fancy luxury car, to ignite the waves of inflation. So that's one angle from it. With the Trump administration, you get a little bit different situation. You don't have the same extent of the spending, but it's still game on with the tax code, right? So there's been deep deficit spending from the Trump administration on account of the tax cuts. And there's basically never any talk of trying to balance the budget from the right wing. So you have two different parties. We say different in that they're culturally different, you know, the culture wars that are being fought at this moment in this country. But when it comes to tax and spend, you have both of them are fiscally expansionist in terms of run red ink. Deficits don't matter in their minds. And when I say in their minds, I'm talking about in the minds of Trumpers and the minds of Biden supporters. It doesn't really matter. Nobody seems to believe that deficits matter. When that happens, you have the seeds being sown for an inflation surprise. Here's what's critical. When you think about what the market tends to look at, oftentimes these market geeks like myself, we look at something called five-year forward inflation. They said the word 5-year twice because what it means is what does the marketplace believe as we can see from quotes right on the Bloomberg terminal that inflation will be 5 years from now? That what will the 5-year inflation number be from 2025 to 2030? It's a gauge for what is a long-term outlook. And the street, based on, I mean, we could transact right now, we can trade bonds and we can price this to the penny. The market believes that we'll have sub 2% inflation in the latter half of this decade. That comes on the heels of monetary expansion. Just, we had to print a ton of dollars here to pay for all the stimulus, the COVID stimulus. It makes believe that all of this money that was created this year wasn't created. And what we have is money supply expansion. For those of your viewers and listeners that have gray hair. I mean, look, I'm just south of 40 years old. I'm barely starting to get some gray hair. All of that Jerry Ford, Richard Nixon, Carter inflation was before I entered planet Earth. So you have mid-career Wall Street types that have never seen inflation. But the thing is the amount of money that was created in 2020 exceeds anything you saw during the Ford or Carter administration by double in terms of year-over-year growth. So narrow measures of money supply, for example, cash, checking accounts, increased 41% in the last year. That's very real money. And it's the type of stuff that you see only right before you start to see an inflation surprise. And just to end the point here, Michael, an inflation surprise doesn't need to be 14% inflation like you had in the latter part of the 1970s. All it needs to be is we wake up one morning, all these people that are working on the street that are 25, 30, 35 years old that have known nothing but the deflationary trend going like this their entire life, to wake up and to a CPI, Consumer Price Index, print, we call it a print, of 3.5% or 4% that pervades for 12, 18, 24 months before suddenly that whole conversation starts starts changing away from, oh, tell me all about communication services and social media and work from home plays and COVID plays and all these concepts within the stock market. And tell me more about some metals and mining company, right? Tell me more about emerging markets. All these various things start to intermingle.
So in that particular case, inflation would be good for owning equities?
Well, there's a few things going on when you think about that. So take, for example, the Standard & Poor's 500. We had a window of time. Again, you have to go back a half a century, but essentially from 68 to 82, where the S&P closed one day in 1982 at the same level as it closed in the middle of 1968. People forget that. Now, generally speaking, anything you hold that is a physical asset, whether it's a house, a building, or a stock, should rise in value when you have inflation. So a good example is the hyperinflation in Venezuela. Not like we're saying hyperinflation, but that stock market is actually up. Of course, you're dead broke because if inflation's running at 1,000,000%, the stock market's up 200,000%, you lost 80% of your money. But you know, that's the way the mentality happens. So if you're running inflation at a surprise, 3.5-4% in the United States, then we need to revalue up the value of the underlying. There is real property, plant, and equipment underneath a lot of these firms. So it does tend to be bullish for the stock market. The countervailing force is whether or not you have it being a stagflation, right? That's the ugly kind that we had off and on throughout the 1970s, where we just can't get our economic act together. We have major problems on our hands. I don't think anybody doubts the fact that, look, we just on purpose laid off tens of millions of people. And a lot of those jobs aren't coming back. There are major rigidities in the system right now. I mean, I'm in Chicago. Our downtown district is toast. Whereas here uptown where our houses are, these restaurants that used to be totally dead on a Tuesday at lunch because everybody was downtown, they're actually vibrant. So you have all these things that are kind of thrown for a loop from all of this. So we have this major, major overhang. You could argue that if we are having this inflationary conversation, it's interesting to be talking about that because unemployed people don't spend a lot of money, flat out. We have, in the very near term, it's almost Thanksgiving at this point, right? So we have Black Friday right around the corner at this point. What is the holiday shopping season going to look like if we're just thinking about 60, 90, 120 day type stuff? What is it going to look like? Do you or do I feel comfortable walking into a Nordstrom, Saks, Macy's, whatever it is? Do we buy it off of Amazon? Has that switched things? What happens to all those retail employees? When you are a retail employee and you're out of work, what does that mean for your rent payment? All these various forces that are disinflationary that we need to definitely take account for. I will say this to just end that particular thought. I think this is something that's very, very bullish in terms of sentiment. There has been this feeling, I've noticed it all I do is all day talk to clients, talk to financial advisors. There has been this feeling that this has been a temporary thing. We've done this on purpose, shutting down the economy to fight the virus, and that we will reopen. It wasn't like Lehman, where a lot of people thought, if you could put yourself back in the 08-09 psyche, this is a permanent depression. This is going to be the 1930s. This is going to be a decade-long thing. But the next thing you know, it's 2010, 2011, 2012, and the stock market is back off to the races, that type of thing. So one of the things that I would point out is if you look at various measures of CEO confidence, so for example, CEO confidence from CEO Magazine, it never had that total collapse like you had from 07 to 09. It held up because I think a lot of people said, you know what? I'm going to cut the dividend for a quarter or two for solidarity with the general public. But I fully intend to be game on for my spending plans, for my CapEx plans for 2021. So I think it's a very positive that has been the mindset. And I'm actually, believe it or not, anecdotally starting to see retailers that I haven't seen before in Chicago, which has a very high unemployment rate, popping up. And I was saying to myself 6 months ago, who would open up a retail establishment in this country knowing what we know?
What's interesting, you know, you're bringing in the current COVID crisis.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, you mentioned that you believe that the market's already factored in a Biden victory. With COVID, it has been my belief that the resolve of the COVID crisis that the market has factored in that it would end by fourth quarter 2021. Mm-hmm. Is your belief that that is, do you think that the market's factored in a Q4 2021 as the end of COVID being a problem? or possibly sooner than factored in?
That's where I was going to go. And remember that when we say that the market, you know, as we discuss right now, the market is pricing a 2/3 probability of a Biden victory. So none of us should be surprised if it ends up being a Trump victory. We'll have to see. So it's not like this is a 90 or 95% probability. There is, of course, the obvious correlation. As people show up in mass for Biden, let's say, then that would tip the Senate. Or if they show up in mass for Trump, that'll maintain the Senate. Remember, the Senate count is 53 Republicans, 45 Dems, and then two independents that vote, that caucus with the Dems. So it's basically 53 to 47. So very, very close in the Senate. Senate is, it's always more fun to talk about the presidency, you know, because it's like a football game between two men here. But essentially the Senate is just as critical. Now, in terms of Q4 2021 for COVID, there's a few things that it's we always talk about in the marketplace is that, look, we all went off to school to study interest rates and valuations and balance sheets and all these things, but you have to be amateur psychologists, right? And we've said in the past many, many years, you have to be a political scientist. And go back, for example, at this point, almost a decade ago, many of us investment strategists had to really, really do a crash course in Greek politics about a decade ago, where you got to the point where you knew more about Greek politics than you did about your own domestic politics, because of the threat of the European Union and all that from the last crisis. Similarly, in 2016, suddenly we all had to really, really brush up on relations between the British and continental Europeans on account of Brexit. Well, in this case, something that I've been thinking about that is critical, and I'm sure you've noticed it in conversations and people joke, they say, oh, 2020 is this horrible year. I can't wait for 2020 to be over. It's almost become like this running joke because we have to have humor for social cohesion when we have the biggest shock to our system that we've ever seen, you know, bigger than 9/11, in my opinion. COVID is just that big in terms of upsetting the apple cart from a societal perspective. But think about what people do. People do mental bucketing all the time. So remember Dow 10,000, right? And then years ago, there was a big stink about when the S&P would cross over 1,000. Now, I mean, it's three times that level, but nonetheless, these round numbers are important to people. We're animals. We think in round numbers. We think in buckets like this. I think that there might be something very critical about the crossover from December 31st to January 1st. There's something about the way we do this in money management, right? Investment performance. Why do we do calendar year 2018 and calendar year 2019? We invented dates. The calendar was invented by human beings, but that's exactly what we do. How has your fund done in this year? And we started from December 31st and run it to December 31st. Well, what if you invested on May 7th? Then you should care about May 7th onward, but that's not the way we do it. So one of the things with COVID psychology is and I hope I'm not conflating my hope with my anticipation. I think that we will get some people that are on the fence between internalizing, okay, we are with COVID is part of us now, right? Even with a vaccine, you know, we have that vaccine for the flu, but it's with us. It's just part of what we have to live with. And a lot of people have had to really battle a difficult 2020 on account of lost loved ones from this one, that we can get some of those people on the margin to say, okay, 2021 is here. It's time for me to go get on a train, to go to a restaurant and internalize that COVID is part of us. Now, in terms of fourth quarter 2021, that would actually be a pretty bearish portent if we're not really back in the mix by then. I think that there is some view that we're coming back. There's a few things that I think could help market psychology. It's an illusion, but nonetheless, people like headline data. And the illusion that I'm referencing is that the third quarter GDP number, so that's everything from June 30th to September 30th, that is going to be announced on October 29th. And it's going to be a gangbusters number. Now, it's really very simple. When I jump into the deep end of the pool, and then I wade into the shallow end of the pool, but I'm still, my torso is underneath the water. I'm still in the pool. I'm not out of the pool yet on the banks. that's essentially what we did. We crashed the economy so hard in the first and second quarter that to the extent that we have a gangbusters number in the third quarter, it's because you're reporting people that went to restaurants and shopping malls or bought a car because the auto dealership was closed. The restaurant was empty, right? And there was nobody getting on the train, these types of things. So we're, from a psychological perspective, we will have this blowout number. I think going back to some of the aforementioned conversation, the blue wave, we'll have to see whether or not that affects the election because it will be announced October 29th. By and large, it is Democrats voting early, Republicans voting on election day. So if you are inclined to be voting Republican, that number might not influence you much anyway because you were going to go pull the lever for Trump anyway. And also we know based on a lot of the data that 96 or 97% of people made up their mind. I don't even know who the 3 or 4% are. Wait, a little joke is I saw the other day, the favorability ratings. Are you strongly favorable for Biden? Somewhat favorable, right? You know, and then don't know. And 2% of the people had a don't know for Biden, and 1% had a don't know whether or not they liked Trump or not. You're just thinking, who are the? I was joking with Cox. Who are these 1% that don't have an opinion of these guys? Because they probably have life figured out. They realize that to just keep your life in order, just pay no attention to any of this, and just live in this blissful ignorance. But I digress. So there's a lot of moving pieces, and just to wrap up on this concept. I think that to the extent that the street, because you mentioned fourth quarter of 21, so now you're thinking in terms of calendar 21, the street is anticipating robust earnings growth in the broad market level and GDP expansion, albeit tepid, but nonetheless, that which we see in the third and fourth quarter of 2020 would seemingly, if the street is correct, on account of stimulus measures that are supposed to be coming, that we would have GDP expansion the first, second, third, and fourth quarters of 2021. To the extent that disappoints, that would be basically bucking a street consensus because everybody's expecting that expansion, and then that would be particularly bearish for equities.
So we wouldn't even wait. We wouldn't really even have to wait till the first quarter of 2021 to see that negative impact.
First quarter of 2020. Well, there's a few things that you could see. So, for example, baked into the cake already, as I stated, the third quarter GDP number. Some things that could get you to roll over is we are now living off of this $1,200 per person stimulus with $500 or $1,000 for the dependent children. And that can sum up to considerable amounts of money that are causing the S&P 500 to levitate, right? So you take, if you're married filing jointly, under $198,000 annually. So say it's husband and wife, two kids. Well, that's $1,200. And then each of the kids is getting either $500 or $1,000, depending on what day of the week is and what the hot air is in Washington. So you're talking several thousand dollars. What is that doing? It's people like us that are moving money around saying, oh, that must mean that we'll hold up the holiday shopping season because, you know, John and Jane Q. Public have $3,000 or $4,000 incremental dollars sitting in a passbook savings account when we know that 40% of the general public, we've seen the statistic, 40% of the public doesn't have $400 for a sudden emergency like a flat tire, car broke down, need to see a dentist for something, you know, those types of things that cost $300, $400. 40% of the public doesn't have that kind of money. And so the notion of continuing, which is also baked in, this give this stereotypical middle-class suburban family with the white picket fence and the dog, give them $3,000 or $4,000 in this quarter, give them $3,000 or $4,000 90 days later. How long can that last? I think the market thinks we'll get several of these. To the extent that we realize this is unaffordable, that could be something that upsets the apple cart.
And I have one last question, and it goes back to the equity question, because you did reference like 1968 to the end of 1970s, where the S&P was, or early 80s, where the S&P was pretty much flat. Of course, the one benefit during that time period was a lot of the S&P components paid really good dividends. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the return was there. So the question there would go, and it's, I think this really ties in, especially with WisdomTree, okay, with having your dividend ETFs. In this environment where if we go into an inflationary period or a perceived inflationary period, and if equities were to do better, would dividend yielding equities be something that would likely actually do better than non-dividend yielding equities? Or does it really not matter?
Well, it depends on what the correlations are between dividend stocks and interest rates, right? So there's been this notion in recent years that dividend stocks like it when interest rates are low because they're competing against each other. However, when you look at data over 30, 40 years, there's actually no correlation at all between what's happening in rates and what's happening in dividends. I think it has more to do with the types of companies that pay a dividend as opposed to the ones that don't. So think about the profile of a company that doesn't pay a dividend: Amazon, Facebook, Google. In addition to those, there's all those other companies you don't hear about that don't pay a dividend because they're on the cusp of Chapter 11 bankruptcy or Chapter 7 liquidation as well. There's a big open season when it comes to why or why not you're paying a dividend. Seemingly when you think about the post-Lehman era, the companies that weren't paying a dividend were the proverbial Googles and the Facebooks of the world were not doing it because they had growth prospects that exceeded the shareholders wanted them to keep the money in-house to reinvest back in the business because the business was beautiful. And when you have a disinflationary, low growth, ho-hum type economy, which has basically been the characteristic of the last 10 or 12 years, anything that can show any semblance of growth gets that bid, which is why the Teslas and Amazons of the world have been so hot for so long. To the extent that that all reverses, you now have a cyclical recovery. Smokestacks are working, right? There is no longer that hunt for disinflationary growth amid a disinflationary trend, because now you have inflation back on. Inflation does a few things. One is, if you have a high debt burden, it liquidates that high debt burden for you and it benefits you. And which types of companies have higher debt burdens? Value stocks, right? So there's, and value stocks are dividend stocks. So there's these various forces. To the extent that we are coming out of this, that there is either A, the psychological crossover to we're living with COVID and we're moving on, or there's the good news, a safe, effective vaccine that allows us to, like that, move on. Then you get that cyclical recovery that tends to help the sectors that are the anti-tech and anti-communication services, because we are reaching some sort of escape velocity. So there's that whole portion of it. And then the other portion of it is, as opposed to the macro, escaping COVID, not escaping COVID, there's just the clear and present valuation rationale for the dividend stocks. So for example, right now you have a 1.7% dividend yield on the S&P 500. That is really low. I mean, it's basically only competitive with you know, treasuries at this point. So it's particularly low. But then when you look at long-term performance, for example, large caps versus small caps, we've seen a 15-year gap here in return on an annualized basis. Over the last 15 years, large caps have beaten small caps by every other 15-year window, aside from the 15 years ending in .com. Same thing with growth and value, where we actually have, when we chop the market into deciles based on PE ratio, the highest PE stocks, the ones that are 40 and 50 times earnings, have outperformed in the last 10 years the lowest PE stocks by actually more than the 10 years up to March of 2000, which was the pinnacle of the dot-com bubble, which itself is arguably the biggest bubble of all times, bigger than the South Sea bubble and Dutch tulip bulb mania from 400 or 500 years ago and onwards. So the case for dividend stocks and value stocks is also beyond, you know, all of us doing a crystal ball on COVID. It's really a valuation case where you have so much stuff out there that just has gotten no love for so long. And it's really been essentially, depending on which index you're looking at, say something like the S&P 500 value index or the Russell 1000 value index, both large cap value indexes, value hasn't worked aside for a few months here and a few months there since basically the period that ended June of 06. So it's been 14 and a half years now. We have no precedent for this, for growth beating value quite like this. And basically you're getting to that point where it's really starting to get into the value never works conversations that you're sometimes hearing. And when you start to hear those, your antenna should go up, because
is value dead? Yeah.
Is value dead? Value never works. And it kind of goes back to this, Michael. I'll leave you with this. Again, when we're talking about inflation and Jerry Ford and Richard Nixon, okay, I was not on planet Earth. I only know about that from what I've been told, you know, when somebody said the gas lines and the OPEC oil embargo, and from what I've read. Well, I know the dot-com bubble because I was a nerdy teenager coming home from school and putting on CNBC and reading my old man's Barron's. He's like a weekend warrior, and I was reading that stuff. But I was a kid. And it's quite possible that you can be well into adulthood at this point. You could be in your mid-30s and have essentially no recollection of a total come apart in growth stocks that happened from March of 2000 to October of 2002, in which certain pockets of the market, when the NASDAQ went down 77%, you know, NASDAQ's down 77% and you're holding eBay and AOL and JDS Uniphase and Sun Microsystems. Remember all those? I mean, half of them are defunct. I remember when eBay was supposed to be the next big thing. And now eBay's just another ho-hum retailer at this point. When the NASDAQ's going down 77% like that, a lot of people lost 80,
90. Even Amazon got hammered at that time period.
Amazon went down over 90%. And believe it or not, if you look at say something like Russell 2000 value, small cap value, from that window of March 2000 to October 2002, which is the 77% NASDAQ decline, it went up. Small cap value made money in that crash because back in 97, 98, 99, nobody even wanted to touch that stuff because it was all about, don't you realize eBay's going to take over the world? Don't you, what are you doing investing in? Remember the auto manufacturers were like, what are you, a dinosaur buying the auto manufacturers?
Well, I appreciate your time, Ed. It's been, you've been very insightful, you know, with everything you went over. So I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hey, take care. Bye.
All right. See you later.